Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have David Shepp, a guest with us. He's a financial consultant who lives in Connecticut, and he's here to talk about an important project going on that many of our readers, listeners might be interested in. Welcome, Mr. Shepp.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here, Mark.
Well, let's get right into it. What is the project?
The project is the restoration of the oldest church in Paris, which is the Church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, Saint-Germain-des-Prés, in the center of Paris, the 6th arrondissement. I will quickly add that anybody who's been to Paris has walked in front of this church.
It's a big, this is a place where all the students go. All the kids hang out down in, right? A lot of, actually this was the old student center in Paris, correct?
The Sorbonne was nearby? It is, and there's a very interesting historic connection between this particular church and the founding of the Sorbonne in the early 13th century. Though, the church itself, and we can get into the history of it if you like, goes back, you can look at it one of two ways. It's either 1,500 years old or 1,000 years old. The current structure is 1,000 years old. It celebrated its millennial birthday in 2014, so a few years ago.
So that tower
is 1,000 years old.
Is 1,000 years old. Well, 1,004.
And four, right. Which is amazing. You can play all these wonderful mental tricks. When it was built, George Washington's birth was 700 years in the future.
Okay.
Things like that, which I think gives a little bit of perspective. That said, there has been a church or an abbey on that exact spot, same footprint, since 543 AD. And so therefore, there was a series of structures before the current one, but it was founded in 543, so it's 1,500 years old.
And what was the original one in the 6th century, was that Saint-Germain-des-Prés also?
It was originally St. Clovis and St. Vincent, but the founder of the church, or the abbey, was Childebert, who was the son of Clovis. And a few years before he died, he appointed a gentleman, Germain of Autun, who became Saint Germain, as the first abbey of the church. And his renown and piety and learning made him a superstar of the time, and the church was quickly named for him.
Okay. Good. I didn't know that. And I've walked by that many, many times. Didn't know the history, but I was an atheist back then. So don't blame me.
Okay.
But anyway, all right. So the project is going on right now, and is it the restoration?
It is the restoration. I want to say, because people have asked me, the church is not going to fall down. It is very solidly constructed, and it will be around for a long time to come. Most of the work is being done on the inside, and that represents a number of things. The damage is on the inside, and it's the typical things you run into in ancient buildings. Leaks in the roof, soot from 1,000 years of religious services, too many people walking through at times, breakage, stoneware just falling to pieces and falling down, some structural damage, which is being repaired. Interestingly, the church itself, in fact, all churches in Paris are owned by the state, have been since 1802, just after the revolution. So the city of Paris owns the outside walls of the church, and they would fix the church if the outside walls were to fall down, which they're not. But all the damage on the inside, which is touching this priceless art throughout the church, has to be restored for the most part through private sources and not the state.
And it's not the Catholic Church?
No. It is a Catholic Church, to be sure. But the Catholic Church, well, the parishioners are contributing as they can. But there has been an appeal in France for the last 4 or 5 years to fund the $6.5 million total cost of the restoration. And then 4 or 5 years ago, an American antenna a separate group was founded in the United States to help fundraise in this country. That's going pretty well, and we can talk about that. But all of the money that is raised, whether it be in France or in the United States or indeed around the world, goes directly to restore the artwork and the architecture and some structural things on the inside.
You sent me a video that was of a French television show that was broadcast that it was covering different historical and pleasing points in Paris, and spent about 8 minutes on the church and the interior of the church.
Yes.
The contrast between the exterior of the church, sort of, it's actually a beautiful, what is it, limestone? Looks like.
Ooh, on you've the, got no. me there. I don't know.
It's a light brown stone, but then on the inside, it is beautiful. It is bright colors. These beautiful murals and the stained glass, and that's one of the things they showed was watching people wash down the murals. And it's like what happened when they cleaned the Sistine Chapel, the ceiling. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, you know, they saw, we didn't know it was this bright and luminous, and that's what you get on the interior of the church. And so I imagine people who go there and just see the beauty inside, especially in contrast to the outside, they're contributing.
Well, they are, and which is great. I really like this church for a lot of reasons, and there are some wonderful churches, you know, in Paris and elsewhere, but this church is very intimate. It's not the biggest one in town by any stretch. In fact, Saint-Sulpice is, and there's Notre Dame, and there's lots of great buildings out and about. But this church, at least to me and to many people, is small enough to speak in a very intimate way. You walk in, and you can see up close all the attributes of the interior of the church, the beauty of the church, the solemnity of this church, the wonderfulness of the many architectural influences that have woven their way into the structure of the church over time. And what's really neat, as you say, Mark, is that you can see now the vivid original colors that were put into this church over time at many different points in time as the church grew and lived over the centuries. And you can see today what it was intended to look like way back when. You can also see where, because the projects are still underway, you can see kind of before and after cases.
Right.
The dark, dark, soot-covered, broken bits here and there, and then where the restoration people have come through and methodically, lovingly put things back to right.
How did you get interested in this? You're not in the field.
I'm not in the field. I'm not in a lot of fields, and this is one of them. I have had the great good fortune of living in Paris, having lived in Paris for 10, 11 years of my life through studies and then through business. I was in international banking in an earlier form of my life. And so, as you know, Paris is not huge. It's hard not to walk in front of this church if you go anywhere. And I took a liking to this church. And over time, to get to the end, I came to know the French people working on the French committee to raise funds to restore this church, and listened to them and followed up on the works and so on. Fantastically interesting. And when I decided to come back to the United States in 2016, they alerted me to the fact there was this American group called American Friends for the Preservation of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, and I might want to contact them. So I did, contacted them, and have been helping them as I can ever since. So really, I was, and may well be again in the future, a resident of Paris, have been in that church 1,000 times, and as I said,
you attended services?
Yes, yes, absolutely, yes, and they're wonderful. The church is almost never empty, and it's filled with I think it's noteworthy for the young vibrancy in this particular church. A lot of young families, young professionals, children of all ages, and then at other times in the week, of course, people from all different communities. There's a Spanish language mass, I think, every Sunday evening. The church is really
Functioning, working church.
Absolutely.
It's not just a historical artifact in Paris.
It's that more than anything else. Absolutely. Yes. Yes, yes.
Now, I wonder if about 70, 60, 70 years ago, if those legendary atheists hanging out across the street in the Café Les Dumagos.
Exactly.
Jean-Paul Sartre and...
He probably didn't get to many masses, is my guess.
He probably sat there and drank his espresso and looked across the street and
said, we've got
to do something about
this. There are pictures of him,
by the way, of him.
And Simone de Beauvoir.
Of course.
Sitting next to him and probably making some acidic comments about those going in and those coming out, is my guess.
Indeed. So why is this church important just beyond its age?
Let me tell you, that's a very good question. I want to talk just for a moment in a roundabout way to get to the answer to your question. Last, about a phenomenon which took place in November of last year, where, as part of the fundraising for the restoration of the church, a number of very involved people put together an auction of modern art in Paris, and it was handled by Christie's, the auction house, who charged nothing for their services. And the committee,
them.
It was phenomenal. The committee went around, and as you know, Saint-Germain-des-Prés, the neighborhood, is the center of a lot of things, publishing, art, galleries, the École des Beaux-Arts is just down the street. So it is a nexus for the art world. Well, the art world rallied, the modern art world rallied big time. Hmm. And a number of modern artists of the highest international order contributed their works to go into the auction, and they raised about $2 million on that. I can't imagine that many of these are anyway, a certain percentage, probably not particularly church-going, but that shows you the fervor to which this church is held, the esteem in which it's held by parishioners and by people who live in the neighborhood and from across the city and indeed across the world. It's old, it's beautiful, it speaks to people, it's been at the center of life in what was first an outside village and then was incorporated into the city of Paris over time. And it's just been there for so long and done so much for the community and is a landmark that it is engraved, I think, very deeply in the hearts of just thousands and thousands of people.
And the artist community.
The artist community.
Which often gets portrayed as anti-clerical.
Absolutely.
If not, you know, postmodern skepticism.
Yes.
And so on. Some of that, so they find in this church something they want.
Something that's
worth
saving.
They want to have.
I think one of the things is that this church has come to us almost in trust. We're 1,000 years down the line now. And it would be a shame if, more than a shame, it would be a tragedy if the art, and some of it goes back 1,000 years, in fact, even more, there are vestiges of the old abbeys way back to 543. If that were to come apart, if that were destroyed or forgotten or neglected, and we pass along to our heirs and successors and the next many generations a church which is no longer functioning, no longer beautiful, no longer speaks to the people as it does. And so I think it's that, this, we are holding this in trust today, and we will pass it along to the next 1,000 years of history better than the shape in which we got it. I think that inspires a lot of people.
And to circle back, you were going to say about what is important about this church beyond, I mean, is there something in the story, in the history of the church that makes it stand out, not just for its age?
Age is history, and there's a lot of history which is not particular around this church, which is not necessarily religious history. It's tied very deeply into the history of Paris itself. And there are many, many examples of this. At the time of the revolution, the French Revolution, for example, there was the revolutionaries took over the church, desacralized it, and turned it into a gunpowder storage area. And guess what? The gunpowder, or the saltpeter, blew up, blowing a number of the walls out. And in fact, the city of Paris came very close to raising the church altogether. And so it's tied into the French Revolution. In the period, Middle Ages.
Why didn't the revolution, the revolutionaries, they went over to Notre Dame and the other cathedrals. And first of all, they just tore down all the statues.
As
And
that happened here as well.
It did.
Yes.
It did.
Yes, indeed. Okay. Absolutely.
But as an older church, was it less ornamental than the newer churches and would evoke less revolutionary ire?
It's hard to say. I do know that at the front door, at the time of the Revolution, there were, much like we see today in Notre Dame, a series of religious statues,
okay,
of religious luminaries surrounding the main door. They were torn out and destroyed at the time of the Revolution. There were other damages done, and the worst thing that was
and,
done...
And the priesthood...
There were, of the... in 1792 or 1793, some refractory priests who didn't like what was going on were ushered into the chapel of Saint Symphorian, which is immediately to the right of the front door, and were massacred. 100 of them were massacred.
100?
Yes. And so that... there's more history. Then, what I like is the history of the High Middle Ages, when the Benedictine order was installed in this church, had been for some time, and they were very busily engaged. I mean, it was a literary and intellectual center for all of Europe, and they were busily engaged in producing, reproducing, copying manuscripts, illuminations, scientific treatises. And what was most interesting was that this included, of course, religious texts as well as secular texts with a growing tolerance for looking at the world as it truly is in all of its aspects. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So that 400-year period or so was in some ways the intellectual high watermark of the church and the history of the church as an intellectual center for the city of Paris.
Benedictines kept it alive.
Kept it alive.
They kept the tradition.
Yeah,
going.
Absolutely. It was a very, very fecund period. And as I you probably know, in the early 13th century, the Sorbonne University was founded. And there was, you were mentioning students, I mean, there's always been the student center. There was a very strong connection between the abbey and the church at Saint-Germain-des-Prés and the Sorbonne. And a lot of back and forth, cross-ventilation, if you like, of the intellectual currents of the time. So it's been the intellectual center of Paris for centuries in many ways, as the whole neighborhood is. And I think that also speaks to people and is another reason to preserve this structure, whether you are particularly taken with its religious significance or not. It still speaks to people on many levels.
And you said the services are packed.
Packed.
And they're all local.
Yes.
Or well, mostly local.
I mean, the 6th arrondissement is, you know, is in the center of, I think, the most resonant and evocative neighborhood in all of Paris, and in many ways the most historic. So the place is filled with tourists and people who come and go, and they, of course, will come to services as well. But there is a vibrant, deep, and hugely involved local parish, which is active in many, many ways.
It's not a story you often hear.
These days,
I mean, we hear the French Catholic churches are emptying out.
Yeah, yeah. I can't speak for other places, but this is really an example of how a church, any church, should be and should live. It's and it does so many things. It has connections to other churches around the world, into Lebanon and the Middle East. It's a very, very impressive place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a museum.
What is the government's attitude toward the project? Are they...
The government is great. I mean, the project is being overseen by the Office of Historic Monuments for the City of Paris, which is a very big deal. And you can't move a stone without getting their permission. They have hired an architect who's been on the job for, a top-rate guy named Mr. Gatier, who is overseeing the project. The project has been laid out from end to end, and the government oversees, or the city government oversees everything and makes sure that it's done quite properly. That said, and I hate to take this back to finance, what does the government contribute? Some starter money, to be sure, but basically, 85% of the cost of restoration, 85%, is being borne by private hands from around the world. The government roughly 15%. And you think, well, that doesn't sound very generous. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But the point is that France, as you know, is so wealthy and rich with historic monuments, all of which are crying for
upkeep. They're all asking, that's right.
There are
right.
not
that's
enough right. dollars, euros, pounds, whatever, to go around as everyone would like. And so a contract was drawn up between the city of Paris and the committee which is running this restoration in Paris. And the funds are going to come, as I say, 85% from private hands.
When will, if everything goes swimmingly, mm-hmm. when will the restoration be complete? More or less complete.
2021, so another 3 years.
That's soon.
And I don't tell anybody, but I think it will probably slip to 2022, just the way these things go generally. All the more so as, and the project, by the way, started in 2012, or I believe it was, when the project was first launched, approved by the city government, et cetera, et cetera. And the project has been laid out in five successive tranches of work. And tranche one has been completed. Tranche two is, I think, being completed as we speak, and we're headed into tranche three of five. And so what's interesting from a funding point of view is that no tranche will be allowed to go forward unless there is in the kitty sufficient funds to get through that tranche. And the amount of money needed tranche by tranche is laid out. It's in the public eye. It's on our website. You can see it down to the last penny. So we're looking at what is called contingent funding. And we're looking now to raise the second half of, as I mentioned, $6 million total cost to get us into and through tranches 3, 4, and 5. So 2021, 2022.
I think there is a strong religious reason to engage in this restoration project. And that really goes back to, well, fundamentally the power of architecture.
Oh.
And its relationship to, well, maybe we'll call it the sublime or God. And it's something I saw in my son when he was about 6. And we took him to services at the chapel at Princeton University, which is a beautiful, large,
yes, gorgeous
chapel. And it was a Catholic service. And we weren't really in the Catholic Church much at the time. But when they, you know, he sat down, we looked, and the elevation, the stained glass, the beautiful carvings, the wood, the depth and height of the space, and then the priest and the retinue coming in with the candles and the cross. You know, I could see his eyes looking all around. It did the job that architecture is supposed to do. He naturally absorbed. It didn't mean luxury. It didn't mean excess. Not at all. Those criticisms didn't apply. It meant majesty. It meant sublimity. He felt that. And so the families that are there in Saint-Germain, the children, I think about, they are the ones maybe who are profiting the most off of this restoration.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. Although that said, and I in a moment or two, we could talk about some of the fundraising that we're doing because there are so many stories involved with that. I have been privileged to hear so many stories from older people. What you say, Mark, is absolutely true. And I like the idea. I used the word intimate. This church is very intimate. And there's a timelessness. Mm-hmm. You feel part of something which is so much bigger than yourself. I think a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, a 12-year-old would get that as well.
You really feel like you're going out of the world.
You're going out of the
you're
world.
You're into another reality.
Absolutely.
Inside.
But what I have really enjoyed is hearing stories from donors or even non-donors who know the church, French and Americans and others, who will tell stories about having been baptized in that church 60, 70 years ago, having been married in that church, having stopped in the church American soldiers on their way to the from the front in World War II, the artists walking by, and just the older people, their eyes glitter, if I can use that term, as much as those of a youngster. Mm-hmm. And I find that just so exciting.
When you go inside, the murals on the wall, those are of?
Those murals are mainly by from the 19th century. They aren't ancient.
19th century, right.
19th century, because remember, let me go back. Well, the church was almost torn down in 1802 and then was restored in the 1820s. And guess who the chief pusher and mover on that was Victor Hugo, the novelist.
Really?
Who was a parishioner, absolutely. And he animated...
Hugo was a parishioner.
Absolutely. How fervent he was, I do not know. But he was absolutely, and he was already world famous in the 1830s, 1840s. He was a key guy in getting the restoration for the church to go forward. So then in the 40 to 1860 period, I have to check my dates, but in that era, Hippolyte, it looks like Hippolyte, Flandrin, F-L-A-N-D-R-I-N, Flandrin, was commissioned by the architect in charge of the restoration, a man named Baltard, to put in these enormous murals. There are probably 12 of them on both sides of the nave, of religious scenes.
And who was he?
He was a world-famous artist who was the favorite student of Ingres, the famous French painter. And he spent some 20 years putting these murals in, which are gorgeous, and which are now being, as you may have seen in the video, cleaned and fixed.
They're beautiful.
And obtaining their original colors. So those things are worth the price of admission alone. I kid you, because the price of admission is zero, of course.
And the murals are of?
Various
Clovis,
religious...
Saint-Germain himself? And...
No, mostly the life of some Old Testament and some New Testament stories. And there are catalogs around. There's some online sites which will explain them one by one, and they are great. What's also interesting, beyond those murals, there are the capitals, which, as you know, are the carvings on top of stone columns all throughout the church, some of which were badly damaged during the Revolution, and the oldest ones of those, which go way back, are now in the Louvre Museum, and so a couple of copies have been put forward. But these were used in a time of illiteracy back in the Middle Ages.
They tell the story.
To tell the story of Christianity, of God and Jesus, and all those things. And you can read the capitals the way you would read a book. Right. So it's all fascinating art history, and is worth the visit and the study.
And the organization, if you want to give the information, it is Americans?
American Friends, the organization, the American Friends of Saint-Germain-des-Prés. The website is preservesaintgermain.org.
S-A-I-N-T.
S-A-I-N-T.
Spell it out.
Yep, absolutely. And there you will see, if I could speak for just 20 seconds on the fundraising. We are fundraising in this country, and by the way, we are a 501c3, a charitable organization, all gifts are tax deductible to the full extent of the law, etc. We are fundraising down two tracks. The classic major donor track, we're looking to raise money as we can from generous people, and we've been very lucky and privileged and successful on that front. But what I also like is our small donor track as well. And that is associated with a campaign that was launched a couple years ago called Adopt a Star. The Adopt a Star campaign is fantastic. There is in the ceiling, the vaulted ceiling of this ancient church, a cerulean blue sky and some 3,500 gold stars. Gorgeous, looking down on the activities and on the parishioners and the priests and so on down below. This ceiling has been digitalized, and on our website, you can go in and actually adopt a star and then name that star for a loved one or a cause, a fallen comrade, a parent, a child, etc. And there have been many, many, many of these already adopted. The Adopt
Well, which is a very, very old practice.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
In the Catholic Church.
Oh,
yes.
Absolutely.
In the cathedral.
Yeah. Yes. But here it is in modern form, and you can run your cursor over the ceiling on our website, and the Adopt a Star, to Adopt a Star, it's $100. And you can put your name up there. And people have done this for families and fallen comrades and all kinds of things. And I really like it because we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of donors who are small donors, such as myself.
Sure.
So you don't have to be a millionaire to help. Everything helps, clearly. And all the money goes directly to the church. We have virtually no overhead. People do respond to that. It's very resonant with
That's
people.
Nice.
It's very nice, yeah. And it's worth seeing, I think.
All right. Maybe we'll check in with you in 2021.
Please do.
And you'll let us know.
I hope we are done or very close to being done. But I would encourage your listeners and readers to visit the church if they can. It's a privilege. And it's just so beautiful. And then to also perhaps look at a website, our website, there are others as well, to get a sense of what's going on. I think it's absolutely breathtakingly beautiful, this structure, this building, and what is being done is amazing stuff. And I like being, personally, a very small part of a 1,000-year history, which will then go into the next 1,000 years, we hope, in even better shape.
Very good. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Mark. I enjoyed this.